But then there's been a positive thing as well, because I think we often think about 9/11 only in the negative sense. We think it happened and all Muslims are now victimized. There is a very positive space as well, in which people from the non-Muslim space who believe in inclusion actually came to the front and they worked with Muslims. So I guess I've been very lucky in the sense that my passion to set up a center was supported by people there.
Welcome back to Herstory. This series gets stuck into the stories of inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. My name's Taylor Strano. I'm with you each week as we meet some of the trailblazing women who've called WA their home. For episode 4, we meet Samina Yasmeen AM. Inducted in 2012, Professor Samina Yasmeen has been dubbed one of the country's most prolific and respected researchers on Muslim identities. She currently teaches political science and international relations at the University of Western Australia and founded the Centre for Muslim States and Societies. She's also a hopeless romantic, and this episode does contain some lovey-dovey recounts of meeting her husband. It's Season 2, Episode 4 of Herstory with Samina Yasmeen. This is Her Story.
My name is Samina Yasmeen. I teach international relations with a focus on religion at the University of Western Australia and run the Centre for Muslim States and Societies at UWA.
Let's start with your childhood. Can you tell us a little bit about growing up in Pakistan? How many brothers and sisters did you have? What was it like being in your family?
Well, I was born in a family where my mother was very strong. My father was also very strong in his own ways. He was the first engineer of Muslim background in Balochistan. And my mother was basically made to marry him, you know, arranged marriage, even though she wanted to be a doctor. And because he was a suitable boy, he was chosen for her. And so my mother had my older sister, and then it was me, and then it was two brothers. Growing up in Pakistan, because my father worked with military engineering service, we would be posted every 2 years somewhere. We were really guided by our mother more than our dad in those early years. And so we were a very strong family, helping a lot each other, being pushed around by our mother, who told us that we had to work hard. So I remember we used to, as kids, we'll come back from school and she would make all four of us sit down and study. So there was this set phrase, you have to do 2 pages of English, 2 pages of Urdu, some maths exercise, and then whatever else we had to. And so that was, there was a lot of focus on education, on ideas. And because my mother loved literature, Urdu literature, we saw her sitting there just reading books late at night when she would finish everything. And so that early childhood was one of a lot of ideas, knowledge, commitment to knowledge, but also a lot of fun. And then, of course, once we started growing up a bit and Mom thought that we had grown up enough for her to focus on her passion, the literature, then she basically became the center of attraction for all kinds of poets, writers, artists. So then growing up became very different, because I remember when I was 12, I thought I was grown up. Our family or our home was where a lot of poets would come regularly. They would stay with us and artists would come in. And so it was a very ideas-focused family. A lot of fun.
I can only imagine being a 12-year-old and having all of these extremely creative people in and around your life. I want to touch on that a little bit more, but first, for people who maybe don't understand or don't come from Pakistan. Can you tell us how what you've just described, your family upbringing, is maybe different from a traditional Pakistani upbringing?
Very different from traditional family upbringing, one, because in most of the families, to some extent even now, it's a father that determines what happens, even for the children. In my case, or in fact in our case, me and my siblings, it was our mother who was the more dominant person. She decided what we would do, where we would go, what we would study, how would we proceed in our lives. And she was very committed to it. So often we still joke about the fact that my mother knew the classes we were in and our dad didn't know which class we were in. So that was the extent of her commitment to our education. But then, other than being the main decision maker in the family, which my father had happily given her the right to do, or accepted her right to do, I don't know if you could give her the right, she just had this personality, she'd do what she wanted to. It was also very different because mostly in Muslim families, or even non-Muslim subcontinental families, women do not socialize with men who are not in the immediate family. And women actually are guided by the men as to who they can relate to, who they can talk to, and what kind of ideas can they even engage with. I think our household was very different because our dad, he would go to work, he'd come back, sleep, get up, say his prayers, watch telly, and go to sleep. All these poets and artists, they would be there, quite against the other tradition in the wider society, just sitting there with my mom, talking to her, sharing their secrets. She knew more about what was happening in Pakistan's artistic sphere, even political sphere, than a lot of very educated people, you know, who had become professionals. She was very educated because she self-taught. So she would be there. And this whole environment, which was filled with writers, poets, artists, politicians, you name it, and even some very poor people who would be given the same respect, it was very different. And I still remember, and I still do realize that growing up in that environment was so enriching and so different that when I grew up to mention those poets and writers and artists, one after another, as uncles or aunts, was sometimes seen by others as name-dropping. And I used to think, but really, they are our family. You know, they come and stay at our place regularly. One of the, in fact, the top poet in Urdu, a Marxist who got Lenin Prize for Literature, and later on even worked with Yasser Arafat and edited a magazine, Lotus, there, Faiz Ahmed Faiz. He used to come and stay at our place, and there was a room in which he and my youngest brother would sleep. So this poet, that wherever he went, people would go gaga, just having him around and get mesmerized listening to his poetry. He was there, and we would just go around. For him, he was Uncle Faiz. We would ask him questions, talk to him about silly things, something that people couldn't even expect. So I guess that whole environment, I think thanks to my mother being very, really unique, way ahead of her time, but also my father being very unique because he didn't come in her way to live her life the way she did. I think we were blessed and we still are blessed because I look back, and even now when something happens and I think, okay, I've got a frame of reference that is different from other Pakistanis of my era, and even Pakistanis these days. You know, you would know one poet or one politician or one artist. But to have so many of them that you lose count, I think that was such a blessing and still is.
To give your children the unlimited access to art and culture and politics the way that your parents did, it is quite remarkable in a Western family, in a subcontinent family, however you want to chalk it up, giving your children a new perspective and way of thinking and learning is extremely valuable. When you think about childhood, Samina, and you think about what you do now and how you arrived there, is there a link there between growing up in a bit of a different way maybe and what it led you to pursue?
I think there's a very direct link because in that environment, and really guided by my mum, but increasingly I realised also with my father in the background, of not being the traditionally male figure in any society, I learned the value of ideas. And one thing that was really important was I learned the value of inclusion. You know what I said, that at our place we would have all this really celebrities, but at the same time poor people who would normally not be treated as equals. And mum would have them come in to the former living area and make sure that they were sitting alongside these rich, upper class, or very artistic people. There was no difference. And her dining table, anyone could turn up and there would be food for them. So I learned the value of being kind to people, and I learned the value of being inclusive and not really choosing people because they're one or another. And I think that's really what I brought with me. And there wasn't one point when I thought I wanted to do this. But I do remember as a kid, because my mom was so much into education, she sent my father's youngest brother, forced him to go and study overseas. So he got his PhD. So I think I was four or three, maybe four, when I knew that mom sent our uncle to do PhD. So that means it must be something good. So I want to do PhD. Didn't know what it was, but I wanted to do it. And then I wanted to be the president of Pakistan.
And there's still time.
And no, I decided that didn't really suit me because it was too much politics, which wasn't really, and still is not me. And then I wanted to do home economics. So I actually got educated. My university education was in home economics. And again, it was a very elitist setup in which I was educated. But a childish thing that I got the highest marks, but I wasn't, my name was not put on the roll of honor, basically made me decide, right, I'm going to go elsewhere. And I told mom that there was international relations being taught in the newly established university in Islamabad. I want to do my master's there. And again, my mom came in really actively in that space, because until then, there wasn't the tradition of young women being educated from home economics to go into international relations. You know, they're two different things. So she met the education secretary of the country, who was a friend, and said she didn't want him to treat me specially, but she wanted him to give me the chance to sit for the entrance exam, and if I pass, to be allowed to do this. So he did. And I don't know what happened. Somehow I got enough marks to get a scholarship and also be admitted. And so that's when I fell in love with international relations. But then all my learning and all my experiences really made me realize from the very word go that there was a different way of looking at world politics. But my love affair with international relations really started then. And then, of course, I worked with the UN Educational Project for a while and then came to Australian National University because I really pined for international relations studies. I think, going back to your two questions, what I learned from my family life was that you need to have a broader vision. You shouldn't be just living in a small parochial mindset, because you can be in the best place and have that mindset. You need to have openness. And so when I came into studying international relations, it just somehow fitted in with my way. And when I started studying it more, I realized that we didn't really appreciate the value of ideas and religion in how world politics was shaped. So then I started moving in that direction. So all up looking back, I think it was really a progression, heavily influenced by what I grew up with.
It's almost like your parents had prepared you to go into this world of international relations by showing you there's other ways to think about things and consider other people's ideas before you even knew that was what it was that you would end up studying. You touched on religion there, and I do want to ask you, how do you define your faith?
I'm a Muslim. I grew up as a Muslim. I was educated about the religion by my mum, and she was educated by her father that she was very close to. But from the very start, she educated me about, again, the openness in looking at religion and its ideas. I remember as a kid, I read something and I repeated that to my mom and said, you know, Mom, Prophet Muhammad said this. So she just laughed and said, there are lots of sayings of Prophet Muhammad that are not valid. And this is, I was 9 years old, I think. And she said, you need to think about the real sayings to know how to live your life. And so this idea that being a Muslim doesn't mean blind faith, it means thinking, researching faith, has really stayed with me. And it has always meant, and I think I've been very influenced by the books that my mother acquired herself, because that was her passion, literature, religion, everything that was with ideas. And so I read some of those books. She sent me some of those books, even when I came to Australia. And in that, my idea of being a Muslim has been all along of being a human being who happens to be a woman, but who has the same rights and responsibilities as others, and who has to bring in her religious principles of kindness and empathy in relationship to others, irrespective of their reading of Islam, or if they're not in the Muslim space, if they're not in any faith space in dealing with them. So I think for me, Islam is very part of me. It's what defines me, but it defines me in a positive sense, not in an exclusionary sense.
Mm. It sounds like it also helped you develop maybe your critical thought skill as well, which I imagine was very handy when you started doing all of your studying and research.
Yeah, I agree with that, because again, you know that one little statement saying, you know, there are lots of sayings, but you really need to know which one is the valid one. I look back and I think, I didn't know the meaning of that, but then gradually as I started reading, I thought, okay, someone would come and tell you this is what Islam is all about. Do you take it uncritically or do you go and search for information? And again, while she was still with us, she would help me, you know, put me in touch with scholars or get me books. And then once she left us, then I kept doing that. So it did help me. And I think that sometimes puts me in a difficult space, because I think, okay, this is what I've learned about Islam and my relationship to God, and I'm applying that in my life vis-a-vis everyone else. But others may not agree with that, and they may be Muslims and they may be non-Muslims or of no faith. Because of the way I've learned about Islam and what it, how it shapes me and my relationship to the world I live in, it hasn't been approved by everyone. Some Muslims would think that I'm not a quote-unquote good Muslim. Others would think that I need still more knowledge, and I know that I do. And then there are others who would just simply label me as a Muslim, with the implied victimization of me as a human being. But I think I've learned over a period of time that I am who I am. And again, a lot of credit goes to my mother. Again, some of the things that she would say, once she was telling me how she, when she was 13, she was taking care of the whole family budget and she refused to order mangoes for lunch. And her father said, hey, I'm the one earning money. Where's mangoes? I want it. I mean, it wasn't that they were short of money. She had a budget and that's what she was offering them. And when she was telling me the story, I said, how could you say that? He was your father. And she said, I am who I am. And it was just, you know, it was my responsibility to manage the budget. So that was my decision. And he just had to accept it. And interestingly, he did. So he was a very open-minded person. So he guided my mother to be that critical, to have that critical approach. And I think she passed it on to all four of us. And we're all, in our own way, very engaged in the world with our own Islamic idea. I don't think anyone among my siblings and my father, who is still there, could be classified as a very orthodox Muslim. It's a very open environment, open thinking, open engagement. And maybe that's why when I found my husband, James Trevelyan, something that I still find now that people don't easily accept their daughters to marry into another ethnic community, let alone culturally very different. Nearly 30 years ago, my father and my mother, they had absolutely no objection.
And I want to speak about your husband shortly. What year did you arrive in Australia?
1979, I think 25th of February.
Can you remember what it was like when you hopped off the plane and arrived here?
Oh, yeah. I came to Australian National University on a Ford Foundation scholarship. So the university had a group of, I think, 8 students, international and national, and they were teaching us about international politics. And they would normally send people, but for some reason, there was some miscommunication, so nobody turned up. So I remember coming off the plane in Canberra, finding that there's no one. So I asked someone at the counter, and I said, you know, I want to go to ANU. So I still remember this guy was wearing long socks, shorts, with a broad accent. He told someone else, hey, Sheila wants to go to ANU. And I'm thinking, my name is not Sheila. And I don't want to go to INU, I want to go to ANU. So he said, INU, I said, no, no, ANU. So he repeated INU, and I still remember thinking, oh my God, I grew up in an English-speaking country because that's what Pakistan has been. And these people, whatever they're speaking, I don't understand. So I went quiet, so which was very different from what I really was as a person and still am. But I think it was a very nice introduction. A woman taxi driver took me to the university, and then, of course, I started living there in a college and loved meeting everyone. ANU was a great place. Then, of course, I went to Hobart, University of Tasmania. That was another great place. But those were the innocent days. There were international students, but not as many. And the knowledge of the world outside was limited, or less compared to where we are now. But that's the nature of the international communication networks. But I had a great time, you know, at ANU and even in Hobart. And then I came back to ANU to finish my PhD there. I still remember it was a really fun, you know, fun student life. Because when I graduated with my PhD, one of my wonderful teachers, Desmond Ball, he passed away. He was a nuclear strategist. My mum came and she really wanted to go and see a nightclub. And the funniest thing is she looked very young, younger than me. So I told Des and his wife that, you know, mum wants to go to a nightclub. So it was so fun that he said, okay. So he actually took me, my mum, his wife, who was near term, and I think she gave birth maybe a couple of weeks after that or a month after that, and took us to this nightclub in Canberra so that we could see what nightclub life was like, which until then I hadn't been there. They were good, innocent, happy, fun, very knowledge creative days.
Yeah. I would love to see a picture of the four of you on the dance floor.
I know.
Somebody fully pregnant. It would be great.
I don't think she danced, but she sat there. But we all danced. Yeah, that was just funny having her there.
Yeah.
Just in this club. I still remember that.
Hey there, if you're enjoying this RTRFM podcast, there's a bunch of other ones to sink your teeth into, including things like Indie Media, a weekly look at grassroots journalism, or maybe All Things Queer, the latest stories and news from the queerverse. You can find them all wherever you get your podcasts from or at rtrfm.com.au. Let's talk about your time at UWA. So you began teaching at the University of Western Australia as a professor in the late 1980s.
Yeah.
Over your years as a researcher and professor, you've looked at many, many things, including the intersection of faith and Muslim and Islamic culture across the Western world, mm-hmm. as well as other places. How do you feel that attitudes towards Islam have changed in Western societies? I mean, you've experienced it firsthand. You mentioned when you first arrived here, the outside world didn't know much about muchness.
Yeah.
But obviously that's changed quite drastically in the last even 20 years.
Yeah.
How do you feel about it now?
Well, I think I did notice a change. I noticed even while I was studying, and that's why I got into studying the role of religion in world politics before 9/11 and started teaching it too. I'm very lucky that I had students who had already been studying about this interaction and the different interpretations of Islam prior to 9/11. But what I always remember is that I would be referred to as the woman who is from Pakistan, a woman who is from South Asia and who teaches international relations or about religion. The moment 9/11 happened, I suddenly became a Muslim academic. I was labeled differently. And even though for all my life I have worked to say, like, we need to look at religion as a set of ideas and beliefs and how they shape communities and people, this idea that there may be different kinds of Muslims and different kind of Muslim women just didn't fit in with people. And then, interestingly, even before that, I had been talking about setting up the center that would focus on Muslim communities. Setting up that center in itself was an issue because some people suddenly thought, why would you want to do that? So I think over a period of time, I have experienced the negative impact of 9/11 and changing perception of Islam and Muslims as not fitting in this society, which wasn't there before or was in a different way. I mean, personally, I never felt that I wasn't part of the society. But after that, it increased. But then there's been a positive thing as well, because I think we often think about 9/11 only in the negative sense. We think it happened and all Muslims are now victimized. There is a very positive space as well in which people from the non-Muslim space who believe in inclusion actually came to the front and they worked with Muslims. So I guess I've been very lucky in the sense that my passion to set up a center was supported by people there. So Professor Alan Robson, who was the Vice Chancellor, first Deputy Vice Chancellor, and then Vice Chancellor at UWA, he was a great supporter of this. If it wasn't for him, I don't think we would have a center, which is the only one of its kind in Western Australia. And so setting that center up in a very different way compared to other traditional centers, what I did manage to do was bring in people from different disciplines to talk about how they see the relationship between whatever they study or research in religion. And that's in one way contributed to the university, but it's also contributed to my knowledge because and the way I live my life and relate to students, because it's made it more enriching for me. I don't know if that...
It does make sense. It's like what you're saying about we only look at certain things in the negative.
Mm.
It's also forced a lot of people to actually
learn something and to really grasp the concept of somebody's faith or belief system. Mm. You're talking about the University Center for Muslim States and Societies. When was that set up?
2005.
So I imagine people were still very much at the time 9/11 would have been at the forefront for a lot of people's minds. We've spoken to women on this podcast before about what it's like being a woman in academia specifically. We've been regaled with tales of no female toilets because women didn't work in academia, so there was no need for it. Other women being looked over for promotions and jobs and so on. As a woman, as a progressive woman, and as a Muslim woman in academia, what can you say about your experience in that way?
Well, it's not different from any other woman, I hope. But I don't think it's my Muslim identity that has stopped me in any way. Because I haven't really... It's what makes me as a person, and it's what shapes what I do in the world. But it hasn't ever stopped me from being objective about issues. So because of that, I think as a woman in academia, I have been quite lucky. I think I've had a very good set of supporters, people who have stood by me, people who have worked with me, even academics who have given their time, or those who have done research with me on how Muslims and non-Muslims look at each other and what is the sense of inclusion and exclusion. I think that has been very supportive. Are there any spaces in which I think things could have been different for me? I think so, but I just think that's where maybe my Muslim background or my Muslim way of looking comes into being. I think there's always a plan. And whatever that higher being is that we call God plans for us. And when things happen, they happen for a reason. And there have been times when things have happened that have really hurt me deeply, comments or actions or decisions. But I look at them as saying, okay, they're there because they test me, but they also teach me something about myself. And so do I let whatever negativity comes my way to drown me in sorrow, or do I accept it and say, okay, it is a test. Let's live through that and see where we come to. I'm glad that I think my trust in God and saying there must be a reason somewhere there, that's why it's happening, it does make me resilient. I mean, my husband may disagree with it because when I'm going through those phases and crying as a female academic and saying, oh, you know, so-and-so said this or so-and-so did that, he has to put up with me having those tears or grumpy mood for an evening.
Have your pity party. It's okay.
Yeah. Yes, you know, something like that. But overall, I think it's a really deep sense of saying there is a higher power that decides what we do in our lives. And that higher power brought me to Australia instead of going to the States, which I wanted to do, but then I didn't. And that's a higher power that brought me to Western Australia. That is a higher power that actually put me in touch with my husband. And that is a higher power that made it possible for me to teach at a very good university. And it's one of the best you could think of. And if there are any difficult moments, I think that higher power will work through it.
You've talked about your husband. I want to come to him now. I have heard, or I've been told, that you are a hopeless romantic.
Who said that?
Can you explain a little bit about that to us?
Well, first of all, you tell me who said it.
I cannot reveal my sources.
Yeah, I am. And again, I think it goes back to the environment that I grew up in. You know, when you're filled with poetry and literature, you think about finer things in life. You think about feelings. But yeah, one of my friends, he passed away, but we jokingly used to talk about my ancestors on my mother's side, who were even more hopelessly romantic. Apparently, one of them was riding a horse and went past some field, saw a woman and kidnapped her. They eloped and they got married. And so when every time growing up, I'd see some good-looking man, and I think that's becoming a bit un-Islamic, but I look at a good-looking man and say, wow, isn't he?
Get me a horse in a field.
So she used to laugh and she'd say, it's your genes. So, yeah, so even growing up, I joke about the fact that I'd have this, every 6 months I'd fall in love with someone new and be dumped by that person and then cry. And it was a set pattern. But I think when I met James, that was the last thing that was on my mind. I met him at a place called Love House at UWA for a training program for cross-cultural relations, for postgraduate training. And he made me a cup of tea without me asking for it. And I love tea. So I thought, gee, this is a nice man. And then we became friends for a year. And then, interestingly, compared to all those other times when I would fall in love and I'd be very aware of it, it took a year for me to actually one day suddenly dawned on me that I think I'm in love with this man. And I think he also had the same idea at the same time. And then, of course, it took some time. We got married because he was married before. His marriage was, I think, falling apart during those years. But I think when I look back, again, that is one of those God's blessings. When I think about it and I think, gee, all those six-monthly intense love affairs that I had on my 50%, because often the other side wasn't really interested in me as much as I was, that happened for a reason, so that at one stage I would become so oblivious to everything that when love came my way, I wouldn't know until it really found its way in my heart. And so luckily it has stayed with me all these years.
That's great.
Yeah.
We talked about your faith before and how it is inherently part of you. When it came to marrying James, can you explain a little bit for people who maybe don't know customary how in Islamic faith that would work? Because he was not an Islamic man, was he?
No. He was a lapsed Anglican. His mother, Dr. Joan Trevelyan, was very much like my mother, Begum Sarfraz Iqbal, very sort of independent, forceful woman in their own right. And she didn't really practice Christianity. James' sister was Buddhist. I think she still is. But anyway, when I met James and when I realized, you know, that moment when the light bulbs went on, I knew that I can't get married to him because in Islam, a Muslim man can marry a woman of the Abrahamic faith, but a Muslim woman cannot. Now, when I'm saying that, there are some people who would disagree and say a Muslim woman can marry, provided, and then there's some conditions. But the dominant view is that a Muslim woman cannot marry a non-Muslim man. So he has to be a Muslim, or he has to convert to Islam. So I remember when we both of us realized that we loved each other, I explained to him. And it was really nice that he basically said he believes in God, in a spiritual being, and so it wasn't an issue for him. So when I told my parents that I wanted to marry this guy, and he came to Pakistan, met my parents, the only thing they said was that he would have to convert. And so he did convert in Perth, William Street Mosque. And that was quite an interesting saga because, you know, having been with me over the year and sort of knowing what I experience Islam as, and he had learned a lot about Islam even from my mom and my dad, mostly my mom, when he was converting to Islam, the different approach was quite amusing. I remember at some stage he was asked to choose a name for himself, and he said, his family has already chosen Islamic name. So they said, what? And he said, Junaid, which is one of the Sufi very significant personalities in history. And there was very little knowledge of Sufi Islam in that group. And they were saying, Junaid, 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 who? Do you know who is Junaid? And then lovely person who took us there and who was the guarantor that this was a really legit conversion, said he will get back to them next week. But I still also remember the funny bit that he was a non-Muslim and I was a Muslim, but as a woman, I was made to sit behind a hospital screen. And as they were asking these questions, my blood was boiling, thinking, you need to learn about your Islamic history. Why are you doing this to this professor? James designed the robot shearing sheep. He's the only Australian who got the highest award in robotics. And this thinking man is converting to Islam, and you don't even know the knowledge of Islam. But anyway, coming back to the question, for him to marry me, he had to convert, and he willingly did. I've always been comforted by the fact that he is happy with the way he practices as a Muslim. He was the one who planned to go to Hajj with my sister, and I was told that we are going to go. And so it's been interesting in the sense, and it's more sociological, because he's of British origin, Anglo-Celtic. Initially and before 9/11, I remember going to restaurants when I'd say, look, I don't eat pork. And James would say, he doesn't eat pork. So they would look at me that, okay, you, we can understand. And then look at him and say, what's your problem? Why don't you eat pork? The idea that you could have Muslims who are of Anglo-Celtic background wasn't really that common. It's still not common. He's a Muslim. He very strongly believes in that and keeps on reminding me about the fact that as a Muslim, I do have ways of being that I shouldn't forget.
Do you sit there when those kinds of interactions come up and think, this is exactly why I do the research that I do?
Absolutely, spot on, because most of my research, in fact, all of my research is really about how Muslims learn about their religion. What do they learn about it? You know, one, how do they do that? Then what is the content? And then how does it shape them in what they turn out to be, in some cases terrorists, in other cases really good, inclusive personalities, and then how does it shape the environment that they live in? So when there are these different approaches that I see, I think, okay, that is the point. It actually doesn't stop me, because then I think, all right, somebody has said something that's different from what I had come across, so then I'll go and do research on that too. Yeah, these experiences often help me, one, learn more about diversity in Islam, but also learn more about how do you bridge the gaps between different communities, intra-Islamic community, but also inter-faith and non-faith communities. You know, what are the spaces in which people don't understand each other?
I just want to talk a little bit about some of your accomplishments. You've been called the country's most prolific researcher and commentator on Muslim identities. How does a title like that make you feel? I can see you raising your eyebrows.
I didn't even know this. I have a very, and I'm not being, what's the word, self-deprecating or something. I truly mean that it's a world with 7 billion people. I'm just a tiny speck in there. I just do what I do, that's it.
But you do recognize that what you do is extremely important and valuable, right?
I think it's very special, yeah. And I wouldn't be doing it if there wasn't a purpose in it.
Mm-hmm.
Whosoever said that, I'm very grateful. But I do that because I think that's where my mother, and I keep on saying even my dad, by not interfering, and then my lovely husband and my siblings, everyone else who's come in, they brought me to the point that I can say things, I can share things, and I want to do them because I think there's a value. Like, I don't want to do it just because things are done. So, yeah, it, you know, you fill my heart with happiness right now just by saying it. But I don't know why anyone said that.
I mean, after this conversation, I think
okay.
it makes a lot of sense. You've been awarded and recognised in many different ways, the Queen's Birthday Honour List in 2014, the Sir Ronald Wilson Leadership Award, the WA Citizen of the Year Awards. I can go on and on. One that I do want to touch on, though, is the West Australian Women's Hall of Fame. Can you remember what it was like when you received that phone call, or that email that said, hi, we would like to induct you to the Hall of Fame?
Oh, yeah. I was over the moon, whatever the expression is. It was like, it's a great honour, and I think that's where I really want to, again, reflect on it. I came to Australia as a young woman. The first time I ever left Pakistan was to come to Australia, and I spent a lot of my time on my own. And then I came to Western Australia initially for 6 months, and to be here and then to teach and really do what I say is my passion. You know, okay, I'm romantic, but I live my life as my passion. And then to be told that I would be inducted, and on the day of my mother's birthday, because she was born on International Women's Day. I just think, by then Mum had passed away, and I still remember thinking, really? It was beyond what I expected. I was, and I still am, honoured beyond words.
Your mum born on International Women's Day.
Yep.
This all makes so much sense now, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, and every International Women's Day, we all celebrate it, and we say, yep. It's Mum's birthday.
In every sense of the word. Every,
yeah. Because, yeah, I just think if she was alive, she probably would have been so proud.
Totally.
Yeah.
Before I let you go, Samina, what keeps you busy and occupied these days? Are you still teaching and researching?
Yep, I still teach. My new project, which I was thinking even I was coming here, is to look at how our younger generation looks at whatever the other is. And we did some interviews with two of my colleagues in Sydney on mothers and the experience of Islamophobia for their children. What I'm moving into is, and I've been trying to do the basic work for that, is to see how children, whether they're Muslim or non-Muslim, children 16 to 18, what do they learn about whatever the other is? How do they learn about it? And then how does it shape their idea of being an Australian? And if there are some differences, how do we create different environment or narrative that can help them go past those differences to be more inclusive? Because I'm very committed to really, years after I'm gone from here, and if I'm still up there looking at Australia and the world down there, I really hope Australia is a welcoming, inclusive, harmonious society. And I think if my research and my teaching can, again, can make the little contribution, I'd be very happy upstairs. I don't know if I'd be in heaven, but I know even if I'm in hell, I'll be in heaven looking at it.
You'll be somewhere.
I'll be somewhere. But I think wherever I am, that's really my passion. That's what I've been thinking of, saying, okay, how do we go into that space so that we go beyond just simply terrorism or counterterrorism or Muslim and non-Muslim to engaging with the difference from a very young age, in a way that actually makes Australia a lot more inclusive society than it has been.
We are doing the hard yards now, and we thank you for it. Samina Yasmeen, thank you very much for being part of Herstory.
Thank you. It's an honour to be included in this, really.
Thanks to Samina Yasmeen and all the women at the WA Women's Hall of Fame. And thanks to the team who make Herstory happen. Our executive producer is Danae Gibson, Sophie Minisale and Madeline Lombardi are our assistant producers. Production assistance from Emily Jane Reed. Our theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses. Artwork courtesy of Peter Roebuck. Herstory is an RTRFM podcast series about the women in the WA Women's Hall of Fame.
This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. This podcast was produced on Whadjuk Noongarrbuja. RTRFM acknowledges and pays respect to the Aboriginal elders of this land, past and present. These lands were never ceded. My name's Taylor Strano. Next week, we hear from the woman advocating for First Nations mothers birthing on country.